KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump's crackdown on immigration has begun. It was a central campaign promise, but do his actions push the bounds of the law and the Constitution? That's coming up on Morning Edition from NPR News. Trump is billing himself as the president who will save the popular video app TikTok. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. He signed an executive order to delay the start of the ban. Where does that leave the app? The president ordered the end to policies that promote racial equity and protect against sex discrimination. And in Gaza, our producer returns to the south to find rubble and skeletons. It's Tuesday, January 21st. On this day in 1977, the late President Jimmy Carter issued an unconditional pardon for those who evaded the Vietnam War draft. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump has declared an emergency at the southern U.S. border. He's starting to fulfill some of his campaign promises. Trump issued scores of executive actions yesterday, many of them on immigration. He's vowed to remove millions of migrants illegally in the U.S. Last week, Trump's incoming border czar said that would include large-scale immigration raids, such as in Chicago. He later said those plans were being reconsidered. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson.
They're a federal agent. I mean, there's, you know, if they come in with warrants, if they come in with their authority, we won't, again, intervene or support in any way. But what I can say is that we have worked with community-based organizations as well as other stakeholders so that the people of Chicago know their rights. And that's the part that's most important here.
He spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. Trump has also ordered a review of the trade deficits the U.S. has with other nations, including China. NPR's John Ruwitch reports China says it is ready to work with the new Trump administration to promote economic cooperation.
Foreign Ministry spokesman Guo Jiakun told a news conference China is ready to strengthen dialogue and communication with the U.S. on economics and trade, which benefit both countries. And he said he hopes the U.S. will work with China towards shared goals. Guo also suggested that Beijing might be willing to look beyond a potential hurdle to that dialogue. China put sanctions on then-Senator Marco Rubio in 2020 in retaliation for U.S. sanctions on Hong Kong officials over human rights. Rubio was confirmed by the Senate on Monday to be Secretary of State. Guo said that while China will safeguard its national interests, it's necessary for high-level officials from both countries to maintain contact in, quote, an appropriate manner. John Ruwitch, NPR News, Beijing.
Meanwhile, in remarks to reporters last night, Trump says he is ready to impose economic sanctions on Canada and Mexico of 25%. Trump says the tariffs could take effect February 1st. Among the other executive actions, President Trump has signed an order to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement. NPR's Julia Simon has more.
Trump pulled the U.S. out of the climate treaty in his last term. This time, he did it on his first day. Almost a decade ago, 196 countries came together to sign the historic treaty. The goal remains to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius over levels in the 1800s. Scientists agree that with ever-increasing levels of climate pollution, the world will see more devastating heat waves, floods, and fires. Trump's decision comes on the heels of deadly fires in Los Angeles that scientists already say were made worse because climate change made vegetation more dry. Climate experts say as the U.S. retreats from climate leadership, other countries are stepping up, including China, the U.K., and the European Union. Julia Simon, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. President Trump has started the process for terminating U.S. membership in the World Health Organization. As NPR's Gabriela Emanuel reports, his opposition to the U.N. agency that oversees global health goes back to the height of the COVID pandemic.
Trump has repeatedly criticized WHO, saying it was slow to respond to the pandemic and accusing the international body of being controlled by China. Trump's critics say the move will leave the U.S. uninformed and unprepared to deal with disease outbreaks.
This is the most cataclysmic decision of a president in my lifetime.
Lawrence Gosting is at Georgetown University.
The terms upon which we engage all of the health emergencies that affect America will be set by others at WHO. We won't be at the table. China will.
The process for the U.S. to withdraw requires a one-year notification period, and this decision could face legal challenges. Gabriela Emanuel, NPR News.
The WHO says it hopes the U.S. will reconsider, and it looks forward to constructive dialogue with the U.S. to help benefit millions of people around the world. Israel's top military general has resigned. Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi is citing the Israeli security breakdown from the Hamas attack on October 7, 2023, that was launched from Gaza. The announcement comes as the Israeli military opened a major operation today in the other Palestinian enclave, the occupied West Bank. At least six Palestinians have been killed there. You're listening to NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantsFoundation.org. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. Coming up, NPR's producer in Gaza returns to the southern town of Rafah after leaving last spring. He found mounds of rubble and piles of skeletons.
We begin, though, with immigration, which is at the center of Trump's first moves as president, and it was a key part of his campaign message that returned him to office.
As Commander-in-Chief, I have no higher responsibility than to defend our country from threats and invasions, and that is exactly what I am going to do. We will do it at a level that nobody's ever seen before.
He signed a handful of actions tied to immigration yesterday evening and rescinding other Biden administration policies on asylum and the border. Some, though, push the legal bounds of the law and the Constitution.
NPR's immigration policy reporter, Ximena Bustillo, has been covering all of this and joins me now. Hi, Ximena.
Good morning.
Good morning. So Trump has made some very specific promises around immigration. What actions did he take yesterday?
Trump signed executive actions aimed at increasing border security and reducing pathways for legal migration. Some included his boldest promises, like reinterpreting the 14th Amendment to mean that those born in the U.S. do not get automatic citizenship, as has been the most common interpretation. Trump also brought back some policies from his first term, resuming border wall construction and pausing refugee resettlement. A few other things happened yesterday as well. He shut down the CBP One app. This was something President Joe Biden created, which allowed migrants to schedule appointments at ports of entry along the U.S.-Mexico border. This created immediate impact at the southern border. People who had waited months to be able to schedule an appointment suddenly lost that chance.
But is everything he's signing legal and constitutional? I'm thinking of birthright citizenship. I mean, can he just end it? The 14th Amendment of the Constitution says all persons born in the United States are citizens.
This is something that he has long promised to do. though this is already being challenged in courts. Last night, a coalition of civil rights and civil liberty groups filed a lawsuit in New Hampshire saying Trump's decision was unconstitutional and goes against congressional intent and longstanding Supreme Court precedent. And others are looking into this too. And there's a lot of unknowns generally about the ability to implement many of these actions. For example, Trump says he wants to send the military and National Guard to the border, but there's no clarity on who would go, how many, or to do what.
I mean, and just a reminder, I mean, Trump's been in power for not even a full day yet. That starts today. But he does have some of his cabinet in place, like Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Does he have his immigration team assembled?
Trump selected South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem to lead Homeland Security, but she has not been confirmed yet by the Senate. There are also key posts at the Defense Department that may need to be in place to deploy resources to the southern border. And agencies like DHS do need congressional funding to scale up their operations. And while there is interest in having border security be a part of the next budget-related measure, that's still several weeks away, if not months.
And speaking of Congress, I mean, lawmakers did actually take action on immigration last night. What did they do?
12 Democrats joined Republicans to pass the Laken Riley Act. This is a bill that would lower the bar for who the Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents can detain and deport based on their crimes, such as theft or assault against law enforcement. The bill now goes back to the House, which is expected to pass it, and this could reach Trump's desk as the first legislation that he signs in his second term. But it might be pretty hard to implement. I got an internal memo from Immigration and Customs Enforcement that said that they'd need $26 billion in just the first year to comply with the order, to house those they detain, and to hire more people to process them.
NPR's Ximena Bustillo. Thank you, Ximena.
Thank you.
Another executive order from President Trump could give TikTok a reprieve. Trump's action seeks to pause the start date of a law banning the social media company unless it's sold. The order also attempts to shield TikTok's business partners from liability so they can support the app without fearing prosecution. So, does all this clear up this legal limbo? Here's NPR's Bobby Allen.
TikTok is in an awkward situation. A federal law recently upheld by the Supreme Court says it must split away from ByteDance, its China-based owner, or doing business with TikTok becomes illegal. That would effectively shut down the app, which is what happened Saturday night. The shutdown lasted for about 14 hours. The app finally snapped back to life after Trump promised to take executive action, and now he has. There are mainly two things he's doing here. First, he's trying to push back the ban's start date for 75 days. Some wonder, how do you delay a law that's already started? And second, he's saying, don't worry, companies supporting TikTok. You won't get into trouble if you keep TikTok online. But some legal experts aren't so sure that'll work.
This is not a power the president has, and he cannot wish it into existence merely by saying something and calling it an executive order.
That's Alan Rosenstein, law professor at the University of Minnesota. He says the president cannot override an act of Congress, and that includes trying to give legal cover to companies like Apple and Google, which control app stores where people download TikTok. The tech giants removed TikTok from their stores Saturday night. That also includes web hosting providers like Oracle. It was among the firms that restored service on Saturday after Trump promised an executive order. The tech companies in the Trump administration did not return requests for comment. Ryan Kahlo has been watching TikTok's predicament closely. He's a law professor at the University of Washington. He says for some companies, Trump's action might be enough to keep TikTok alive, even if the law does technically say otherwise.
They're more afraid of Donald Trump getting upset with them than they are of a legal threat under a binding law passed by Congress.
Kahlo believes it's a risky gamble. He says, think about it. If a company is not being prosecuted because Trump tells his administration to leave them alone, well, what if he changes his mind?
The minute he withdraws his support, if he does, then that's when TikTok goes dark, and that's why everyone is currying Donald Trump's favor.
It's possible, Kahlo says, that some of these questions will ultimately be decided by federal courts. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Palestinians are starting to return to their homes in Gaza now that a temporary ceasefire is in place. Many are finding utter destruction. NPR's producer in Gaza, Anas Baba, spent the first half of the war in the southern city of Rafah after being displaced from his home. Then he had to flee again. Yesterday, he returned. NPR international correspondent Aya Batraoui has this report on what he found.
Rafah is nothing short of apocalyptic. Gray mounds of rubble as far as the eye can see, and piles of skeletons where bodies have rotted away. This is what Palestinians are encountering in Rafah now, a city once teeming with international aid workers and more than a million displaced people. Israeli troops launched a ground offensive against Hamas on Rafah in early May, forcing people to flee. And this week marks the first time Palestinians have been able to safely return. Riyad Abu Mahsin says his blood's boiling from what's been done to his city. And he's exhausted by the scale of destruction around him. He doesn't think Rafah can ever be rebuilt. NPR's producer in Gaza, Anas Baba, says the city and its main road are unrecognizable.
8 months ago, this street was called Paris Street in Rafah. But now, it seems that the Israeli bombardment left nothing from this Champs-Élysées of Rafah. We can see that the infrastructure, the streets, roads, water pipes, every single thing that's needs for a human in order to be inhabitant place is lacking here in Rafah.
Buried below all its rubble are the memories and lives of its people who once lived here. A woman looks with disbelief at the mound of concrete and twisted metal under her feet. This was her home. A man tells her, put your faith in God. Through tears, she repeats, Hasbunallah wa ni'mal wakeel. God is sufficient and the best disposer of affairs. Nestled near the border with Egypt, this once quiet town became a lifeline for Gaza after Hamas-led militants launched an attack on Israel in 2023 that killed 1,200 people there and sparked the war. Rafah became the main entry point for aid into Gaza for the first half of the war and hosted Palestinians from bigger cities. But Rafah was never safe. Out of the more than 47,000 Palestinians killed in the war, according to Gaza's health ministry, thousands were buried here in Rafah. This is what it sounded like at the main hospital's morgue in Rafah in the first months of war. Here, a distraught man fell to his knees, surrounded by the bodies of his relatives covered in white shrouds. In those first months of the war, NPR reported on many of these deaths from the Abu Yusuf al-Najjar morgue, documenting entire families killed in Israeli airstrikes. The military either would not comment on specific strikes or would attribute them to its aims of dismantling Hamas, which it accused of using civilians for cover. The al-Najjar hospital today, like much of Gaza, is a charred shell of itself. There's only debris where its departments once pulsed with life. But there is one bulldozer outside, carefully, slowly, working through the rubble. Osama Ali, a manager at the hospital, says he spent 17 years working in its wards. He says, we don't know how to come out of this. The situation is very hard. He says he doesn't know how to express how he feels inside, seeing Rafah in the hospital like this. Rafah was a battleground between Hamas and Israel for the past 8 months. Israeli forces killed Yahya Sinwar here in October. He was the mastermind of the October 7th attack on Israel. Since the ceasefire started Sunday, people have been making their way back to Rafah and other parts of Gaza. But their nightmare is far from over. There are losses here of lives and homes that can never be put back together. In one destroyed home in Rafah, a boy dusts the debris off a golden-colored curtain stitched with flowers. The road to recovery here is long, but for some, it has already begun. Aya Botrawi, NPR News Dubai, with Anas Baba in Gaza.
This is NPR News. On the next Fresh Air, Jesse Eisenberg joins us to talk about writing, directing, and starring in the film A Real Pain. He and Kieran Culkin play cousins on a Jewish heritage tour in Poland, which includes a stop at the Majdanek death camp. We'll talk about how the story relates to Eisenberg's life. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. From Cunard, offering travelers an opportunity to voyage aboard Cunard's Queen Elizabeth to Alaska. Guests can experience Glacier Bay National Park and Hubbard Glacier, as well as locally sourced cuisine. Learn more at cunard.com. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Martinez. On his first day in office, President Trump revoked several executive orders related to racial equality, environmental justice, and discrimination against LGBTQ people. Here's how the president put it in his inaugural address yesterday.
This week, I will also end the government policy of trying to socially engineer race and gender into every aspect of public and private life.
Trump's move upends many of Joe Biden's policies put in place at the start of his term. To talk about what this might mean for federal agencies, I'm joined now by Gina Abercrombie Winstanley. She's a 30-year diplomat and former U.S. ambassador to the Republic of Malta, and she served as the first diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility officer at the U.S. State Department for 2 years, ending in 2023. So President Trump has said he's getting rid of diversity programs in order to forge a society that is, quote, colorblind and merit-based. Ambassador, how do you respond to that?
Good morning. Well, the intent is exactly the same with the DEIA programs. I believe too many people misunderstood and worked from fear and responded with fear, thinking that DEIA was simply to put another group at the top of the pyramid. DEIA is designed to level the playing field to ensure that merit-based decisions and merit-based advancement is what happens in federal agencies.
So if the intent is the same, does it matter then that President Trump said what he said?
In some ways it doesn't, because every employee and study after study show want to belong to an organization that does base its decisions on merits, that is an inclusive organization, that gives them an opportunity and confidence that their abilities, not their race or their gender or their social background, is going to allow them to get ahead. However, by putting out this executive order and all the things that have come up to this, strike fear in people's hearts so that they may not choose to make the right decisions to help all employees as opposed to just ones that are within the in-group, as it were, or look like them, or in this case, may be of European-American background.
But are diversity programs, are they still needed?
I believe so, yes. But programs that actually raise awareness that the issue is out there, that make clear when you have a percentage of positions in an agency, senior positions, that are over 80% for one group, but that's not merit-based. Statistically, women and minorities are not less capable or intelligent than majority American men, and therefore something else has gone into that result.
Are we not clear on that, though, Ambassador? Are all those things you just mentioned, are we not clear on those things?
Well, we may be clear on it, but we haven't resolved it. We haven't put in place things that allow merit-based decisions as opposed to our internal biases that lead us to choose people that we understand easily or that remind us of ourselves or that have been in this place. They look like what we're used to seeing, and so we don't look further.
One last thing, Ambassador. I mean, are DEI programs going to be on a sort of cycle where if there's a Republican in the White House, it'll likely go away, and if a Democrat wins, it may return?
Yeah, I don't think so, because I think everybody, as I said, wants to belong to an organization that is inclusive. So even if the name changes, the work is going to continue. People will walk into rooms, and if they don't see a level of diversity, they will know the right people are not in the room.
Ambassador Gina Abercrombie-Winstanley is the former Chief Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, and Accessibility Officer at the U.S. State Department. Ambassador, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Next, we look at the risk of your household pet catching bird flu. The USDA says more than 70 cats have fallen ill with bird flu in the last 3 years. Many of these kitties lived on dairy farms and got sick after drinking milk from infected cows. But several house cats have recently died from the virus after eating raw pet food. And last week, the Biden administration's FDA said it's requiring cat and dog food manufacturers to consider bird flu in their food safety plans. Sarah Bowden reports.
My doctor does not want me to eat uncooked meat or drink unpasteurized milk because of diseases like E. coli or Salmonella. Most veterinarians say it's the same for their patients. Your cat might be a vicious mouser, but they're not wild and shouldn't eat raw chicken. That's especially true now because of bird flu.
Cats are a sign that this virus is in products that are available for sale and that potential for human consumption exists as well.
Dr. Jane Sykes specializes in infectious diseases in small animals at the University of California, Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. And her cat, Freckles, eats regular kibble.
I have no concerns about her getting high path avian influenza.
That's bird flu. And Freckles is an indoor cat, but many cats spend time outside and hunt songbirds or rodents, which all might have bird flu. So keep an eye on Tiger, says Dr. Michael Q. Bailey, who is the president-elect of the American Veterinary Medical Association.
Say they're lethargic, they have runny nose, they have discharge in their eye. I would strongly recommend that you contact your veterinarian and say, hey, I'm concerned about my feline friend, and can we have a consult?
Bird flu might also cause neurological issues in cats, like dizziness or seizures. Those can be symptoms of rabies, too. So, to avoid confusion,
make sure your pets are vaccinated for the diseases that they can be vaccinated for.
In case you're wondering, no, your cat probably won't get you sick with bird flu. At least, not right now. But bird flu is really good at mutating, says Sykes.
This is a very scary virus, given that it can infect so many different host species.
That means the more cats that get sick from raw food, the more chances the virus has to evolve, which is bad for everyone, whether you have a cat or are more of a dog person. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Bowden.
This is NPR News.
President Donald Trump has returned to power as the nation's 47th president. He promises a raft of policies targeting immigration, gender, energy, and more. I'm Elsa Chang. Join us as we unpack Trump's first full day in office on All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. President Trump focused heavily on border security and immigration during his inaugural address. He's declared a national emergency exists on the southern U.S. border, and he signed scores of executive actions on immigration issues. NPR's Tamara Keith reports that Trump is taking aim at one right that is protected by the U.S. Constitution.
Trump is already testing the limits of his executive power, including with an executive order that would end birthright citizenship for the children of people who are not in the country legally or who are in the U.S. lawfully but temporarily.
Birthright. That's a big one.
Birthright citizenship is written into the Constitution, and Trump admitted he doesn't know whether his order will hold up to legal challenge.
It's just absolutely ridiculous, but, you know, we'll see. We have very good ground.
The order was part of a stack of executive actions signed by Trump in the Oval Office just hours after being sworn in. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
The ACLU is filing suit over the birthright issue. Among the flurry of executive actions Trump has issued is one that pardons nearly all of his supporters who rioted at the Capitol 4 years ago. President Trump's choice for Secretary of State is on the job. Marco Rubio was sworn in this morning by Vice President J.D. Vance. He was confirmed by the Senate last night. And you're listening to NPR News. Israeli forces have begun a new operation in the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. Palestinian authorities say at least 6 Palestinians were killed in a strike and 35 wounded. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports from the West Bank. The violence comes in the first few days of a ceasefire in Gaza.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office called it a, quote, significant military operation to combat terrorism. It said the name of the operation is Iron Wall, and the goal was to, quote, strengthen security in the West Bank. Jenin has long been a militant stronghold and the focus of many Israeli military raids since the war in Gaza began. Many Palestinians here worry that the Israeli military may shift focus over to the West Bank now that there's a ceasefire in Gaza. Meanwhile, dozens of Israeli settlers wearing masks burned and damaged property in a Palestinian village over the weekend, according to a statement from the Israeli military. The military says it was deployed to disperse the attacks. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Ramallah.
Amid the military operation in the West Bank, Israel's top general is stepping down. Lieutenant General Herzl Alevi says he will leave his post in March, citing the security failures that allowed Hamas's October 7th attack. At the Australian Open tennis tournament, Novak Djokovic has moved into the semifinals. He beat Carlos Alcaraz today in their quarterfinal match at the first Grand Slam of the year. I'm Giles Snyder. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from ECMC Foundation, at ecmcfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. President Trump issued pardons and commutations to every single defendant charged and convicted in connection with the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol.
Yeah, that includes people convicted of assaulting police on that day with bath poles, pepper spray, and other weapons. More than 140 officers were injured on January 6th, and their injuries included crushed spinal discs, traumatic brain injuries, and a heart attack.
NPR's Tom Dreisbach has been covering the attack and the pardons, and he joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So take us through the pardons and the commutations that Trump issued.
Right. So almost every single defendant got a full unconditional pardon. That means their conviction is forgiven. If they're locked up, they get released. If they were convicted of a felony, they get their gun rights back. And that group includes more than 400 people charged or convicted of violent assaults on law enforcement, driving a stun gun into an officer's neck, for example, beating officers with a bat. And then just 14 people are getting these commutations. So they still have a felony on their record, but they are getting out of prison. And all of those people are linked to the far-right groups involved in January 6th, the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys. Most of that group were convicted of seditious conspiracy. But I should say the headline here is everyone charged in connection with January 6th, whether they pleaded guilty or lost at trial, whether they assaulted cops or not, whether they were found to be violent extremists or not, they are all getting relief from Trump.
I mean, it's not a surprise, right, that Trump had promised pardons for January 6 rioters for years. But were you surprised by the scope?
Well, yeah, members of the incoming administration had said this would not happen. Vice President J.D. Vance told Fox News earlier this month that, quote, obviously they should not pardon people who assaulted police. In fact, Trump has embraced, however, even the violent January 6 defendants for years. At his rallies, he featured a song with the January 6 defendants recorded on a jailhouse phone singing the Star Spangled Banner. He calls them hostages, says they were treated unfairly. And even rioters were attending inaugural events, including a rioter named Timothy Hale Cusinelli, who prosecutors described as a Nazi sympathizer. And he once went to work at a naval base with a Hitler mustache, compared Orthodox Jews to a plague of locusts. And he actually posted his invite to the inauguration on social media.
Wow. Where does this leave the January 6 cases?
Well, federal law enforcement said that January 6th and the attack then was an act of domestic terrorism, and they launched the largest single criminal investigation in the history of the Justice Department in response. Trump has essentially undone all of that with the stroke of a pen. And for police officers who were hurt, their families, this was the worst case scenario. They are watching people who assaulted them or their family member get out of prison. Of course, many defendants, on the other hand, are celebrating today. Jacob Chansley, the rioter many people know as the QAnon shaman, the guy with the horns that was seen in the Capitol, he said he's going to buy some guns now that he can legally. And then there's the larger concern I've heard from counterterrorism experts, extremism experts, that this essentially is an endorsement of political violence by the incoming Trump administration, as long as that violence is against Trump's opponents. The Proud Boys have kept a much lower profile since January 6th, but they were actually back out on the streets in D.C. on Inauguration Day. And given their history of violence, that has a lot of people worried.
That's NPR's Tom Dreisbach. Thank you so much for your reporting.
Thanks, Layla.
President Trump talked a lot about energy in his inaugural address.
The inflation crisis was caused by massive overspending and escalating energy prices.
So he said he'll declare a national energy emergency.
We will drill, baby, drill.
NPR's Camila Domonoske covers energy. Camila, so what does it mean to declare an energy emergency?
Well, as President Trump was signing this order last night, he said that it means you can do whatever you have to do to get out of that problem. In truth, this is partly symbolic. This is a way of saying that energy is a big priority, but it is also material. Emergencies do give the president new authorities. This executive action mentioned some provisions in the Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act that are designed for crisis situations.
I remember seeing, reading, or hearing somewhere that the U.S. makes more energy than it needs right now, right?
Yeah. I mean, certainly, if you compare today to the energy crisis of the 1970s, when there were acute energy shortages, people waiting in line for gasoline, former President Jimmy Carter urging people to wear a sweater in a big speech, this is not that, right? Scott Siegel is an energy policy expert with the law firm Bracewell.
One of the things that makes this really different in the current situation, we don't have an oil embargo or an oil shock going on right now in the United States.
In fact, the U.S. has abundant oil and natural gas, is the world's largest oil producer ever, and a net exporter of fossil fuels and energy in general.
So those words, abundant, largest, I mean, so then what does the administration mean when it argues there's an energy emergency?
The order mentions that demand for energy, specifically electricity, is growing thanks to things like AI centers and manufacturing. Siegel says, yeah, that's not the same kind of emergency as an oil embargo, but it is a genuine challenge for the electric grid. Economist Diana Fershkot-Roth runs the Energy Center at the Heritage Foundation. She supports this declaration. And to her, this is really a response to the Biden administration's climate policies, things encouraging electric vehicles, trying to cut emissions from power plants.
So this is causing a legacy of future problems, a future crisis, by having required electric vehicles at the same time as the price of electricity is rising because power plants are closing.
So the view here, which is echoed by the order from Trump, is that the emergency in question is, in fact, policies designed to fight the climate crisis from the previous administration.
All right. So now that Trump has declared an emergency, an energy emergency, what's he likely to do?
Well, with the caveat that we don't know for sure, but Trump has pledged to cut regulations. And Fershkot-Roth thinks that he could use the declaration of an emergency to make it easier to roll back some of those climate policies from the Biden administration. There's also the possibility to use executive power to make it easier to build things like pipelines and power lines, power plants. You know, one thing that we're not going to see is support for efficiency, saving energy. We were talking about the crisis in the 70s. That was a hallmark of former President Jimmy Carter's response. But we know Trump does not share those views. He's complained vociferously about things like LED light bulbs and efficient showerheads and dishwashers, and a separate executive action pledges to give shoppers more choice on appliances, roll back those standards.
I work on Morning Edition, Camila. I don't have any energy. Anything can be done about that? I guess not. That's NPR's Camila Domenici. Thanks.
Thanks, Ed.
Pardons and energy to the flurry of executive actions from President Trump on his first day back in the White House. We're covering several others elsewhere on the show, including immigration. We'll keep following all these executive actions and many more issues as the week unfolds. Now, here's your listener action. You can stay connected by listening live on the NPR app or your local station. This is NPR News.
We continue our look at the loneliness epidemic by learning about third spaces, not home, not work, places offering us a vital social connection. Next time here and now.
The latest in national politics, inspiring podcasts, and a report from your local school board meeting last week. You can hear it all in one place with the NPR app. Download it today.
Good morning, I'm Layla Faldin. Could you go a full month without whining? Well, a no complaints campaign just launched yesterday in the Netherlands. Isabel Ganissen started the campaign in Belgium 7 years ago. She says she was tired of hearing complaints about things like traffic and refunds. She even created a complaint barometer so people can see how much they whine. But I think I'll keep whining. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. at uma.com/NPR. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. The truck attack on Bourbon Street earlier this month has thrust New Orleans into a total rethinking of security in the French Quarter. Some residents now want parts of the quarter to be pedestrian only, no cars allowed. Here's Matt Bloom with member station WWNO.
When you step on to Bourbon Street, you immediately see the classic French Quarter architecture, Hard Rock Cafe, bar signs up and down the street. And then you see a memorial with hundreds of bouquets of flowers and 14 crosses representing each of the victims.
It's so touching, it's emotional for sure.
Sarah Stansfield is in town with family and paying her respects. Those 14 people were killed and dozens injured when a driver easily swerved around a police barricade on New Year's Eve. Now, police still put up barricades in the evenings, but French Quarter resident Chris Olson doesn't feel totally safe.
It would be very easy to drive onto Bourbon from any of the cross streets. You can just cross it, or to drive the opposite way down the street, and there's nothing there to prevent it.
The city plans to unveil a new removable bollard system ahead of next month's Super Bowl, but Olson says the neighborhood needs a more radical fix. He wants the busiest stretches of Bourbon and nearby Royal Streets to be off limits to cars. He's launched an online petition asking the city council to consider it.
Obviously, it doesn't prevent everything from happening, but it definitely would be a huge step in the right direction.
His idea isn't totally new. Since the 1970s, people have been trying to make this happen. Business groups have always rallied against it, saying it limits delivery times. But in the wake of the attack, there's been no opposition to his idea. Groups that have opposed it in the past, like the French Quarter Management District, declined to comment for this story. Instead, over 5,000 people have signed Olson's petition. One of them is April Camarada. She's the owner of Masquerade, the quarter's last handmade mask shop.
It's basically wearable art.
She says even before the New Year's Day attack, she had concerns about pedestrians getting hurt.
I see people driving full speed towards families crossing the street right here on Royal Street. There's nobody stopping that.
Shutting the street in front of her shop down might make getting deliveries a bit harder, she says, but she's willing to do it if it means her customers feel safer beyond just high-profile events that always have extra security.
It's a long-term commitment. We have to be able to protect the pedestrians here in the summertime, too, and make sure that it's just as serious then as it is during Super Bowl.
The city recently hired former New York Police Commissioner Bill Bratton to help beef up security. In a press conference, Bratton didn't mention a pedestrian-only zone as an option, but listed a number of other common safety measures.
Whether it's utilization of drones, whether it's utilization of better cameras, better lighting. There's so many ways to enhance the security.
Bratton's full report is expected in about 2 months. But Olson thinks the city council should take action now.
We're finally trying to do something about it, put some real change in place so that this doesn't happen again.
So far, council members haven't taken up the idea. But Olson says it's the only way to ensure year-round safety in the city's largest tourist attraction. For NPR News, I'm Matt Bloom in New Orleans.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin.
Is today the day Donald Trump will announce new tariffs? Because yesterday wasn't the day.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Affinity, provider of the CRM for the private capital relationship economy. Affinity knows who has the best relationship with the right startup. Affinity knows. Learn more at affinity.co/marketplace. And by Viking, exploring the world in comfort. With a fleet of small ships, Viking offers travel experiences for the thinking person. Discover more at viking.com.
I'm David Brancaccio. More now on President Donald Trump's executive orders right out of the gate. Mark Goldwine joins us this morning. He is Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, a nonpartisan organization with bipartisan roots. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Voters spoke early and often about their anger over inflation. President Trump addressed inflation yesterday by, what is it, directing every piece of the federal government to deal with it. I looked for details and didn't see details. What about you?
No, I mean, so look, I wouldn't say he addressed inflation, but on the other hand, I wouldn't say what he did was particularly strange, right? So a lot of the executive orders you're going to see early on are sort of orders to start thinking about how to make orders. And that's what this inflation one is. Does it solve inflation? Does it even reduce inflation? No. But might that get somebody in some agency to think a little bit more hard about not worsening price increases or bringing them down? Perhaps it could. Either way, it's mainly sort of a statement of the administration's priorities more than an actual change in policy.
Now, on federal government workers, the president's getting strict on remote work for federal workers, but a hiring freeze, including at the Internal Revenue Service, something you will have noted in the work you do.
Yeah, and look, it's supposed to be temporary while they, quote, figure things out. Overall, hiring freeze is an opportunity to save the government money. Maybe it's not the most efficient one, but it allows you to have a smaller workforce. The interesting thing is one agency that's supposed to be really ramping up its hiring is the IRS. And the reason is that they were given special funding to expand their tax enforcement. And if we don't let them ramp up their funding, that's lost tax revenue. This policy would actually worsen the deficit, assuming this freeze is allowed to stay in place.
And a lot to digest here, but from your first and second read through, are you surprised by what's not in here?
Well, we heard there's going to be tariffs on day one. I didn't see tariff policy. What I did see is some announcements about what tariff policy might happen. And I think he talked about a tariff on China related to TikTok, but we didn't see any announcements about the tariffs themselves. And that was really what President Trump ran on. The other thing, and this doesn't surprise me, but it might surprise some listeners or some people that have been listening to the campaign stump, there wasn't a reversal that I saw of the electric vehicle rule or some of the other bigger, costly Biden executive actions. And the main reason for that is a lot of these actions actually go through the rulemaking process. And so they do take time to unravel. You can't necessarily just snap your fingers and do it on day one or day two.
Mark Goldwine, Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
President Trump has issued a slew of executive orders on energy as well. He established a national energy emergency and started the process of trying to roll back some Biden administration energy policies. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer looks at some of the impact on his attempts to increase energy production.
The National Emergency on Energy is meant to increase energy production. It's partly a response to the soaring power needs of the data processing centers used in the development of artificial intelligence. The National Emergency allows the government to use the Defense Production Act to increase and speed up energy production. President Trump signed another executive order that would reopen Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil and gas drilling. Another executive order is aimed at rescinding former President Biden's restrictions on drilling in areas along the East and West Coast. The idea is to boost energy supplies and stabilize prices, but the U.S. is already producing record amounts of oil, and it's not clear that U.S. energy companies want to expand drilling in the areas that were off limits during the Biden administration. Plus, the global oil market sets prices. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Also just now, Trump's nominee for Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent cleared the Senate Finance Committee. Let us do the numbers. The Dow is up 307 points, 0.7%. The S&P is up 0.4%. The NASDAQ is up just slightly 11 points. The bond market up today, bringing the 10-year interest rate down to 4.56%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping protect small businesses and the owners who run them. Whether a plumber, accounting business, or restaurant, Progressive can help with over 30 customizable coverages. Online quotes available in as little as 6 minutes at progressivecommercial.com. And by Glassdoor, announcing the best places to work in 2025 based on anonymous reviews from real employees. See who's hiring at glassdoor.com.
President Trump painted a dire picture of the U.S., and few would say there isn't room for at least some improvement. Now, that said, America's job creation machine has been going gangbusters. Unemployment is down. Wages have been rising faster than inflation. But consumers, well, that is a bit of a conundrum, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Consumers have been spending a lot, but they still feel pretty mediocre. And as political power has shifted, consumer sentiment has too, says Joanne Hsu at the University of Michigan surveys.
Republicans believe Trump's policies are going to usher in growth, lower inflation in the future, whereas Democrats are quite worried that inflation is going to come surging back.
All that drives consumers to spend more.
Republicans are spending out of confidence, Democrats out of fears that things are going to get worse. If you think prices are going to go up in the future, then now is the time to buy.
Meanwhile, LendingTree reports Americans' monthly debt payments keep rising on credit cards, car, and home loans. But analyst Matt Schultz says most borrowers aren't getting in financial trouble.
If you're feeling good about your job and your overall situation, you're not necessarily scared of taking on debt.
Especially if it's to invest in education, a home, or small business that could build future wealth. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
And the Wall Street Journal is reporting that some in the crypto industry are dismayed after the president and first lady launched coins, $Trump and $Melania. These are unregulated and potentially highly volatile tokens that go up or down based on the vibe online and have no wider economic purpose. Some crypto boosters see these as countered efforts to make systems like Bitcoin or Ethereum more legit. I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
I sat with a girl in the moonlight. Her eyes were so big and so black. I still feel the kick that she gave me, 'cause I put my hand on her.
Sweet Violet, sweeter than all the roses, covered all over from head to foot, covered all over with.
I once took a shave and a haircut. The barber was drunk, goodness knows. He took out a big brand new razor and cut off the tip of my
sweet violet.